everyone. I'm sure everyone's wearing green today, except me. Figured that out when I got to the office. We do have a few in attendance visiting tonight. If you could introduce yourselves and your affiliation or school or organization, that'd be great. Slot to hand it over to our youth representative, Bryce Hackett, just to give us a brief update. He's had some extraordinary experiences over the last couple weeks, and appreciate your participation. If you could just give us a quick overview, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Trevor. A couple weeks ago, for the February Board of Health Board of Health meeting for the county, I testified on behalf of the Advisory Council to support or to urge the council to support some new legislation that's currently being formed on the state level regarding e-cigarettes, specifically House Bill 1645 and Senate Bills 5477. They expressed that they would fully support the new legislation, and I believe that there was some other debate about that. Dr. Lomick also did talk about some vaccinations, and I'm not quite sure what the full how that fully ended up playing out. Yesterday, I traveled up to Olympia to testify in front of a House committee, the House Committee for Gaming and Commerce, regarding House Bills 1645 and Senate Bill 5477. I presented alongside the vice principal from Marysville Pochuck High School and other school employees from around the state that were testifying in support of these bills, which would basically restrict youth access to these e-cigarettes. I'm not quite sure what the committee's final decision regarding their support or lack of support for these bills are, but that information should be coming out shortly. Thank you.
Great. Appreciate it. Also saw the photos today that were forwarded by Roxanne. Appreciate that on the Capitol steps. Very impressive.
Picture.
Yeah. You can route that for a quick look, if you would.
You want to just hand it around?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead and move into the update. There's a few follow-up items. Dr. Melnick's going to walk us through that.
Great. So as Bryce was talking about, and that should be on your agenda, it should be House Bill 1645, not 645, and Senate Bill 5573. So we, as you remember from last time, the Public Health Advisory Council wrote a letter in support of these companion bills around these vaping devices. And Bryce did a really great job of presenting this to the Board of Health, last Board of Health meeting, and the Board of Health went on record as supporting these two bills. And that works out really well because when the Board of Health does that, the lobbyists for the Board of Health and for the county can actually go and support this legislation in Olympia. So that works out really well. So it's clear that the Board of Health is on board in supporting this vaping legislation. We're going to talk about it a little bit more when we get to the to the SIP law piece. So as you recall, the vaping legislation that our board supported and that Price testified on is still moving forward in the legislature, both on the House and Senate sides. But it would actually, it would do a number of things. There'd be penalties for possession by minors. It would prohibit the use of flavorings and, you know, like all the fruit flavorings and chocolate flavorings. It would prohibit the use of addition of psychoactive substances to these vaping devices. You can put just about anything in them. So there are a number of things that these bills do, and it's moving along in the legislature. And the also about marketing to minors. You know, they have the cartoons and all that other stuff that make it more attractive. So anyway, it's moving along in Price. You did a great job representing us really well. Also at the last Public Health Advisory Council meeting, you expressed support for House Bill 2009, and what that would have done, would have done because the bill died in the House, but what the bill would have done was remove the philosophic exemption for vaccination for school exclusion. So parents have a choice. There's three ways you can be exempted from the requirements for immunization. One is a religious exemption, another one is a medical reason for not getting vaccinated, and the third reason is the philosophic or personal reason for not having your child, not giving your children the vaccination. And the vast majority of exemptions, overwhelmingly, and we're statewide around 6%, I believe, or somewhere around there. Most of them, vast majority of them, are due to personal exemption. So we felt that getting rid of the personal exemption would have gone a long way to supporting herd immunity and reducing the risk to the public from vaccine-preventable illness such as measles. So you wrote a letter in support. We brought it to our Board of Health. The Board of Health, what they decided to do, they had concerns, and you can go on to CBTV and you can look at the if you want to see the film, the video from the Board of Health hearing. They were concerned about, which is, I think, we're hearing elsewhere, they were concerned about the rights of parents to choose the philosophic exemption, individual rights versus the public good was a concern for them. So they determined, they didn't really say they were against it or for it, but they wanted to see how it basically played out in the legislature, because they thought, they knew this bill was being heard in the legislature. And anybody from the leadership team, correct me if I'm wrong about this, my memory is incorrect, but basically what happened is it was being deliberated in the legislature and the bill died. So that doesn't mean it won't, you know, sometimes these things take a few sessions to work along until, you know, the public mood changes about this stuff. I learned a valuable lesson about this in terms of how I frame it and present it, is that it's not just individual rights versus of the parents not to give the shot versus the public good, but the parents of kids who, for medical reasons, can't be immunized, or who are too young to be immunized, they have rights too. So we may need to frame it a little bit differently the next time. I'm learning lessons in terms of framing this, but I really do appreciate the Public Health Advisory Council doing what you're here to do and giving your recommendations to our Board of Health. And, you know, it won't happen this session, but, you know, down the road we can look at this again. So I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. Kind of, yeah. So the bill is gone. So that's the piece about the legislation. We're going to talk about the ordinance in a minute. But one of the things that the vaping legislation, just coming back to that briefly, is one of the things the vaping legislation doesn't do is require electronic devices. We're calling them inhalant delivery systems. Doesn't require them to be, doesn't regulate them the way smoking is regulated. So that, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on the agenda in terms of the ordinance. So the bill doesn't do anything about that. So right now, these devices are unregulated in terms of where you can use them statewide. Then the other piece I want to talk about is, let's see if I can find the I may have lost what you gave me.
Yeah.
No, I found it. Okay. So every year, the National Association of County and City Health Officials has a, I don't know if I call it a contest, but they have an application. You can talk about something that you're doing in your health department that basically works really well as an innovative practice, and that the reason for that is when local health departments come together for the NACHO annual meeting, and health departments from all across the country come together, different health departments can learn from each other's best practices. And we they're called promising practices and model practices. And actually, it gets posted on the NACHO site too in the resources. So other health departments can look on in that resource and say, wait, hey, we may want to be doing this in our health department. It has a lot of promise in terms of improving the health of our community. So they have two categories. One is called a promising practice, and one is called a model practice. The only difference really between the promising practice and the model practice, you get to present and give a talk about your model practice, but the difference is that model practice has generally been around long enough to have some data associated with them longer term, so they can be really accepted as a model practice. So we submitted, our staff submitted the title was Partnering with Faith Communities to Tackle Inequality, and basically it's around our faith-based activities, including our faith-based coffee. That was submitted, our staff submitted that as an application to NACHO, and was rewarded a promising practice. So that is really good, and hopefully we're going to continue gathering data. We could resubmit it as a model practice later on when we have more information about it, but the fact that it was recognized from applications from all over the country, there's a limited number that they accept. It was accepted as a promising practice, and I wanted to mention that here. I don't know if our folks want to say anything else about that. Or
We have an outstanding staff member who put this together, Ann Johnston, and she was key at putting this together. She's been key at developing this process, so I would like to recognize her too. She's done a terrific job.
And she submitted the application.
Correct.
But I think for people who don't know, tell people what the big case, what she's doing. Tell people who don't know that.
Do you want me to?
Would you mind?
Yeah. No, not at all.
You've got the history. Mind.
Well, essentially what she's done is brought the neighbors together, the community together, and I've found a way for all the different faith organizations and the schools to come together, and now they've included other partners to meet the needs of the students in the community. And so at first it was a real challenge because we had such a strong separation of church and state, and the churches not being comfortable in schools and schools worried about the churches coming in and preaching or whatever. But she's brought this together, so all these denominations are at one table. They're working very closely with the schools. They've done all kinds of activities to help the schools meet the needs of the students in their neighborhood. It's a pretty amazing group.
And they kind of like broker.
Yeah.
They even have a website around this, and they broker needs with resources. So there's a lot of resources among members of the faith community, and it's a way that you can actually tie needs together with the resources available. Right?
I mean, one example was the schools around wintertime. A lot of their students didn't have coats, winter coats. And so they sent the word out through the different churches, and those groups came together and they brought in bunches of coats for the students. And so it was just like an easy way for them to meet the needs of those students.
If I understand right, isn't there a second one now over on the east side of, like, through Evergreen High School? Or
yeah, they're just starting it up, yep.
Have we presented faith-based coffee to the public health department?
No.
We can actually.
I thought Ann Johnson talked about it once.
Call her up. Get her over here now.
A long time.
She did a presentation, I think, along with Debbie Hammer right around that same time.
Mm-hmm. We can certainly bring her back, though. Yeah. It's a very impressive.
Yeah. And we actually have some folks from the faith community come join her, probably, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about what they're doing.
I'd like to have her come back, because then we can also recognize her for her leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. You know, I think
great idea.
Nice that we could, you know, the way to recognize her for her leadership and innovation and doing that.
Yeah.
We could start out as a one-person
idea.
You know, rallying the resources and become a full team now.
It's just huge. Yeah, it's really grown.
So that's for the end of my report.
Thank you. Moving on to the Healthy Youth Survey results, which is also Dr. Miller.
Oh, I guess it is. I should introduce. I'm sorry. I should. It is. It's listed under my report, and I apologize. But Adiba Ali is going to talk about. She's one of our epidemiologists. I think you've been here before, right?
It's been a little while, so some new faces.
She's going to report the latest Healthy Youth Survey is done every 2 years. She'll describe that to you. And the latest, the results are beginning to roll out from the latest Healthy Youth Survey. So I'll let you describe it.
Sure. So I'm just here to kind of share the latest data that have just come out. So most of you have heard about the Healthy Youth Survey. It's a school-based survey administered every other year throughout the state on youth health risk behaviors. It's a collaboration between Department of Health, DSHS, OSPI, and the last iteration was in October of 2014, and the data was just released last week through the state. So the survey covers a host of topics: substance abuse, nutrition, physical health, mental health, community risk factors. And the state this year is taking the approach of doing topic-specific focuses. So each month, focus on one particular issue and kind of go deeper. And so they started off doing substance abuse. So I thought maybe I'd take this opportunity to share what the latest trends are related to substance abuse. So that's the handout that you have in front of you. So I'll just kind of go through some of the highlights and kind of talk about the trends. So in terms of alcohol-related indicators, this is one of the indicators that we're actually seeing positive trends. Generally, alcohol use has gone down. I just wanted to mention, I'm going to report out results on 10th graders. So the surveys on 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, but typically report on 10th graders. You have the best participation rates, and it's also representative of that middle adolescent age, but I can also get you data on the other grade levels. So 10th graders are reporting, about 20% of them are reporting current alcohol use, and so they're answering the question, in the past 30 days, how often did they drink a glass, can, bottle, alcohol, beer, wine, coolers, or hard liquor. And this is down from about 28% from 2010, and our rates are similar to the state. We ask about binge drinking, where they ask, how many times have you had five or more drinks in a row? A drink being a glass of wine, beer, shot glass of liquor, or a mixed drink. And about 12% of our 10th graders are saying that they did binge drinking, and this is also similar to the statewide rates. And again, if you look at that top right figure, you'll see that the binge drinking rates are also steadily coming down from about 16% in 2010. At the bottom, it asks about sources of alcohol. Most youth are saying that they're getting alcohol from friends or at a party or at home with or without permission. On the back side of that sheet, we talk about youth perceptions of alcohol use. More and more students are saying that there is great risk associated with alcohol use, regular alcohol use. So we have about 73% of our 10th graders saying that they think regular drinking is risky, and our rates are comparable to the state. And again, our rates are improving. So this is up from about 67% in 2010. The top right graph talks about drinking and driving. And so kids were asked whether they rode in a car driven by someone who had been drinking alcohol. About 17.6% of 10th graders saying yes, they have. But this is down from about 22% in 2010. And then with respect to drinking and driving themselves, about 5% of 10th graders are saying that they drove a car while drinking. And this is also improving from 2010. It's down from 6%. And then the last piece of data on alcohol use I wanted to cover was anti-alcohol messaging. More and more kids are saying their parents are talking to them about the harms of regular alcohol use. And this is conversations that are not related to the harms of drinking and driving. And so this is a really positive sign. About 60% of our 10th graders saying that parents are talking to them about reasons not to use alcohol, and it's up from about 50% in 2010. So then,
what do you attribute the downward trend over the past 10 years to? Is there anything in particular?
So
on the front page, upper right.
Yeah. So those trends. So I would say so the binge drinking and the current use drinking. Those trends are significant coming down.
Yeah, but what do you attribute it to? Any causes?
Well, I think all the prevention programs coordinated by DSHS, and they look at a lot of the community norms associated with alcohol use as being, because there's a lot of messaging and prevention work around alcohol use, but I think when we look at some of the other substances, we haven't had that much of that in our curriculum, so I don't know if anyone wants to add to it.
Has there been more advertising in alcohol prevention?
It's been consistent. I think tobacco and alcohol are two of the substances that we've had consistent prevention work happening over the last decade. Whereas with e-cigs and marijuana, we'll see it kind of as the emerging issues, we're seeing kind of more alarming.
If you look at page 5, the marijuana page, it looks like the growth, that's actually gone up. So,
yeah. Let Adiba get through her
report. You asked a question, I was just trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know if those are connected yet. So yeah. Let's go through the thing and then we'll.
Yeah. The alcohol and tobacco, I mean, we're seeing a lot of positive trends, and I think there's a lot of programs throughout the state addressing it. And I think it's interesting in contrast to the other substances that we're seeing. So tobacco use. It's about 10% of our 10th graders are saying they have used smoked cigarettes in the last 30 days. And we've consistently been a little slightly worse than the state over the last decade. But the rates have consistently come down. So we're down from about 14% in 2010. So the alarming piece here is e-cigarette or vape pen use. We're about 20%. So it's double the number of kids saying they're using e-cigs and vape pens. And we're actually also a little bit higher than the state. The state is about 18%. We're at about 21% in terms of using e-cigs. This is only the second time e-cigs was asked about in the survey. 2 years ago it was asked, but they didn't use the word vape pens or e-cigs. It was just, have you used e-cigarettes? And so just so you know, about 4% of kids said they used e-cigarettes 2 years ago, and now it's 21%. I don't think it's comparable because so much more marketing, it's so much more prevalent now, but it's an alarming figure.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the exact statistical term for it, but is there in the statistics, is there any indication of, say, of that 21%, how many of these other categories of those kids double use? And so, you know what I mean?
So how many of the kids are using e-cigs are also saying that they smoke cigarettes and smoke alcohol? Yeah, we can. I don't have the raw data for the latest set yet, but we can definitely look at that at the county level.
I would like to see that.
Yeah. So I wanted to move on to marijuana, which is the next page. Starting off about talking about attitudes around marijuana use. I think this is the most interesting piece of data to look at. About 34% of our 10th graders are saying that they don't perceive, or they perceive very low risk of harm from regular marijuana use. That's up from about 29% in 2012 and 25% in 2010. So the perception of risk is going down. In terms of marijuana use, about 19% of our youth are saying that they currently use marijuana. This is similar to the state rates. And if you look at the trend there, the black line is the current use. We're not really seeing a whole lot of change so far, but the maroon line, that red line, is going up. So that's those perceiving no or low risk. The other thing about the marijuana question is this year they changed the way they asked it. They used to say, have you smoked marijuana? And now they're asking, do you use marijuana? Because there's the edibles and the liquid forms available now. And so they also ask about how youth are consuming marijuana. So most are saying, of the students that say they use marijuana, most of them are saying that they smoke it. About 15% say that they're eating it. And then about 5 to 7% are saying that they're vaporizing it. They also asked this year about driving and riding in a car with someone who used marijuana and driving a car themselves within 3 hours of using marijuana. So about 18% of our youth say that they rode in a car with someone who had been using marijuana. About 9% of 10th graders said they drove in a car within 3 hours of using marijuana. And in the 12th grade category, about 17% of our 12th graders are saying that they've driven a car within 3 hours of using marijuana. So the last sheet in your packet here is sort of a summary covering all of these substances, but I just wanted to draw your attention to prescription pain medication. So the surveys asked about prescription pain drug abuse since 2004. And we've actually seen the number of kids saying that they abused painkillers to get high go down. So from about 9% in 2006 to about 4% in the latest survey. The new question that they asked this round is about prescription misuse, so the wording's a little different. Have you used prescription pain medications that were not prescribed to you? So it's a bit more of a subtle way to kind of get at the question, but about 6% of our 10th graders are saying, yes, they did report misusing a prescription drug, and it's 8% of the state. And I just wanted to kind of point that out, you know, in light of the prescription drug abuse epidemic happening and the transition from prescription to heroin also happening. So that's just kind of a quick highlight of some of these substance abuse topics. You guys have questions? And it was just real quick. But I can share more detailed data with you if you're interested.
The thing that's concerning is on the marijuana, and I think we talked about this last time, you know, that that there's no or low risk of harm mm-hmm. from marijuana. Mm-hmm. You know, that 34%, and that's gone up mm-hmm. from 25 to 20. That's really alarming, you know, because that's in the general population, you know, because it's not legal. There's no detrimental effects from it.
Yeah, and we haven't seen a huge change in the number of kids reporting current use of marijuana, but I'm curious how that's going to change in the next few years with, you know, licenses being out just last summer, this survey was in the fall, so it's just that, you know, we're just at the beginning of kind of maybe seeing these numbers changing.
One thing we know, you know, from kids and studies with kids, certainly with tobacco, is that when they observe adults doing particular behavior, or they observe something that's, but they observe the language that adults use about something, and they adopt those behaviors. So I'm not saying that's the cause of this, but as marijuana use gets more common among adults, we can expect that kids will be using more as well.
So did the survey target 5,000 participants and 4,610 were responsive, or how does that number work?
Yeah, so the survey was done with most of the school districts in the county. The target is usually, so this is the number of students that answered the, in 10th grade. So there was over 15,000 students in the county who actually did the survey, combining all the grades together. And I think it was in the range of 6,000. So the denominator is like the number of enrolled students in that particular grade.
Okay.
One other thing I want to highlight about this, I mean, you're talking about marijuana, but if you look at, and it's also nationally, the number of kids or proportion of kids that are using vaping devices, inhalant devices, electronic, is growing very rapidly. And, you know, as that was in that vaping bill, they're not only efficient nicotine delivery devices, but they're also, you know, put other psychoactive substances into them. So we're very alarmed about the increased use of vaping devices as well. Why we're testifying on that legislation.
You know, getting back to that, the attitudes about marijuana use, like, it makes me wonder, you know, we know that overuse of alcohol creates problems. And it's like, obviously, overuse of marijuana creates health problems and societal problems. It's like, what's the campaign for safe use of marijuana? I mean, is it, you know, you think about, there's got to be some public education that, you know, what is, when is it too much? You know, because, I mean, that there's this perception that it's, because it's legal, it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know if we have the answer to that question, but it's certainly, you know, something that, you know, we collectively are going to have to deal with in terms of the consequences of increasing use of this in terms of, you know, health effects as well as driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's certainly plenty of taxes to do some public mm-hmm. education about, there's youth education specifically. So
I was also just thinking about the Prevent Coalition and all the other groups in the county doing prevent substance abuse prevention work, and the newer Drug Free Communities grants are specifically asking for interventions related to marijuana and e-cigarettes. So the efforts on cigarettes and alcohol have been ongoing, but these are kind of newer elements that are being funded for.
I'm going to go back to, I guess it's page 5 now.
Yeah.
But it's a dramatic decrease of alcohol use mm-hmm. as opposed to looking at everything else, which is kind of uptick. What is the difference? Is it just education programs? Or, you know, because I'm sure they all have education programs, but why is one more successful than the other? Is it something else? Or nobody knows?
I don't think these data tell you why. I mean, they tell you what's going on. We can hypothesize why this is going on. I know, you know, with tobacco, we have some fairly good evidence about, you know, why smoking rates are going down. But I mean, we could do a literature review and see if there is there any data out there in terms of why folks think the alcohol. And I don't know whether it's true for just Washington, whether other states as well. You know,
I think we can certainly research what all has been happening, but just the fact that it's been around for so long, and just marijuana and...
Well, marijuana's been around since I was a kid in high school, so, you know.
But it's always, I mean, there's been a stigma, it's been illegal, it's not talked about the way alcohol and cigarettes were talked about.
I mean, when prohibition went into effect, alcohol use actually dropped significantly, so making something legal actually increases use and availability. So that's kind of inevitable that's going to happen.
Well, whatever the magic pill is, I wonder if we could apply it to all the other substance abuse programs and see the same effects over time. I was just curious.
Mm-hmm.
part of it could just be shifting, you know, if it's harder to get alcohol and something else is now more readily available and cool, all of a sudden people could, you know, people want to alter their consciousness. They might, you know, I was doing this, but now I might just go over and do this, you know, what have you. That could be a factor in it as
that,
well.
That actually happened with methamphetamine use was higher a number of years ago and became more. Remember when we were pushing for methamphetamine became more difficult to get. Now the most common drug that's used is are opiates because people are getting prescribed opiates, and then heroin is dirt cheap right now. So that's why we're seeing epidemic levels of opiate use and opiate overdoses. So. Yeah, you know, your point is a good one. Depending on availability, there's a lot of factors that go into this, but price and availability certainly enter into the equation.
It's a market.
It would also be interesting to put some of this on control graph and see where the change occurred and then look back and see, you know, what is it that actually precipitated this and whether these are really significant changes or not. Mm-hmm. I think if you can look back at where it started, maybe you can figure out where we could really get some concept.
Well, we'll get into it a little bit more and maybe get back to you with if we have any of the why answers for you. Mm-hmm.
Great. Any other questions for the youth survey results at this point? Thank you for attending. It's great information. I'd like to make an amendment to the agenda and move up the marijuana discussion in regards to post-legalization. We have a state trooper that's visiting us tonight, allowing him to get back to work or wherever he needs to be. And then we'll move proposed SIP law regarding vaping devices right behind that. Thank you, Chief Richardson.
Okay, I'll start. I'm going to pass around some handouts here, but just so you know, I brought 15 of each, and so you might have to share, but there's some. Number one is what I've got here is kind of anecdotal. It's talking to people. It's not hard research, so don't beat me up. This is just the perception. And, you know, I tell you, I'm a pretty conservative guy, but I'm up to Washington, and all of a sudden I'm a pretty liberal person. I don't know what happened to me. But there's two different articles in there. I'll have to pull them apart. But when we get started, they asked me to give you perceptions of police chiefs and what we think is going on with the legalization of marijuana. And I think it's important to understand that I think it's a good perspective for me, and I also talked to the chief of Vancouver and then some of the other chiefs. Battleground and Vancouver are really the only two cities that have actual retail, up and running retail outlets in Clark County. And we also have commercial grows. So we have buildings where they actually grow indoor marijuana. They harvest it several times a year. It's high tech. There's $2 or $3 million invested in the infrastructure. And they also have, it's just like wine, something like, if you haven't gone into a retail marijuana outlet, it's kind of going, it's like going into a wine store. It really is. They have different kinds of marijuana, different brands, they have their THC levels different on the label, and it comes from all kinds of different places, and they all have their own branding. Just like the different vineyards, there's different marijuana farms, and they have their own labeling. It's pretty sophisticated. So I think as far as crime, and we're talking legalized marijuana, we haven't seen any increase in crime, nor have we seen any increase in calls for service. As a matter of fact, in most cases, even our marijuana store, they actually call me every month and ask, hey, how's everything going? Do you have any issues with our company, blah, blah, blah. Part of that is it's heavily regulated, much more regulated than the liquor market is. When they grow marijuana in this state, when that plant's about 6 weeks old, that plant's barcoded. And it's tracked all the way through the system to point of sale. So they know how much is going into the system, we're talking the legal market, and how much is actually going out to retail stores, and they have to balance their books every day. So many plants go in, so many plants go out, and that are product. And they're also getting, most of the retail marijuana places also sell infused products. And those are also labeled with the THC content and the dosage. They found that out from Colorado where you would go and you buy a marijuana-infused candy bar, it would say take one piece, you know, the Hershey bar, and somebody eats a whole bar, and then wonder why they go to the hospital. So that's one of the issues. It's actually much more regulated than the liquor market, retail liquor outlets. You know, now in this state, ever since we, Battle Run used to have one liquor store, everybody knew where to go to get it, very contained. Now everybody sells liquor. So liquor's going out the door right and left because people are shoplifting it. Our shoplifting calls have gone up because of retail theft. You don't have those issues right in the marijuana industry right now. So I can tell you that why I think it's that way is, number one, heavily regulated. Number two is the owners of these establishments have hundreds of thousands, and in some cases, if you're a grower, millions of dollars invested in their industry, their business, and they know that they're being watched. So they're very very careful. They have cameras all over the inside of these places. The liquor board can turn the cameras on and watch what's going on. So for me, and I'm just telling you my perspective as a police chief, and not, I don't represent, when I'm talking about this stuff, the philosophy of all the police chiefs in the county, because they're different, just like everybody else has a different opinion. I'm beyond worrying about whether marijuana should be legalized or not, because it's out there. You know, the door's open, the horses are gone. So for me, the police chief, my thing is two issues, really. Driving under the influence of whatever, I don't care what it is, prescription drugs, marijuana, alcohol. And number two, how do we regulate it and keep it out of the hands of kids? So that's where I'm coming from with this. Another perspective I have is that, hey, we have to regulate the medical marijuana industry in the state, or the retail legalized marijuana industry is going to fail. And that's because we have this black market out there that doesn't have any regulations. They don't pay taxes. Their products aren't tested. So you've got that out there competing with a legitimate businessman. And a lot of our complaints, believe it or not, come from legitimate business people that are selling legal marijuana who have invested a lot of money into the business, and the guy down the street's throwing it out his door, and he's not paying taxes on it. He doesn't have the overhead. He doesn't have employees. So those are the kinds of things that I think the state's trying to do right now. How do we merge those two markets together? And I think until we fix that issue, I think that we don't know what's the impact going to be. Another issue for us in the state of Washington, just like liquor, is Oregon's going to legalize marijuana. Their taxes are going to be less than the state of Washington. So if you live on a border city, just like alcohol, people are going to drive across the river to get their marijuana because it's cheaper. It's just what they're going to do. You know, everybody drives over to Costco to buy your appliances over there because you don't pay sales tax on it. So that's the way that, not everybody, I just heard the story. Just saying, allegedly. So that's going on. And before, I want to talk a little bit about my perspective on traffic safety. And I'll turn it over to Cooper because he's here, because he's the expert. And WSP, a lot of the stats I get are from WSP. WSP is monitoring a lot of the blood draws, how it impacts the state. But I can tell you, talking to Marianne, who's our traffic safety coordinator here in the county of Clark, but also she's been talking to the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, marijuana is really our number one issue in the state right now, especially when it comes to young people. Now, I can't verify these stats, but most of the people that are going into drug treatment now for addiction, young people, they're addicted to marijuana. And the younger you are and the younger you start marijuana, the more likely you are to get that addiction. And the problem in our society is our parents kind of condone marijuana in their heads because marijuana is obviously, I smoke marijuana, not me, but they're saying, because I'll be one of those people that never smoked it. They're saying, well, I smoked it when I was in school, what's the big deal? That's what parents say to their kids nowadays. And that's, parents say that to us when we arrest their kids. But THC and marijuana back in the 60s and 70s was 1-4%. And now in the retail outlets, it's 10-30%. And if you start talking about hash oil, it can get up over 90%. So it's much more potent than it used to be when in the 60s and 70s. I think the delivery system, and I use e-cigarette vapor pens, now I'm going to use the inhaling delivery system, the IDS system, that we're experiencing that now in our classrooms, in our community, because kids can put hash oil in there. It doesn't really smell. You can use a very small amount, and they can use it, and you don't catch them. They could go across the street and do it. So, and when they're driving down, you drive down the street, you don't know what's in that device you're smoking. It can be tobacco, it could be juicy fruit flavored oil, or it could be hash oil. We don't know. So I think that that's an issue that's not regulated in the state. We were, Washougal just passed an e-cigarette ordinance. We were going to kind of duplicate theirs, but we're kind of waiting to see what the state does now, because I don't want to have a go through the process of having an ordinance and the state law comes along and kind of supersedes that. So we it does need to be regulated, because right now we don't really have anything we can do with the kids. And the other issue we have in our communities is, what do you do with either e-cigarettes or tobacco if you do come across a kid that's 17 years old? Throwing them into the system isn't necessarily the fix, because you want to, you know, if they're addicted to anything, you've got to fix that addiction issue. And I also sit on our juvenile justice board, and we talk about that all the time, that, hey, finding a juvenile or saying, hey, send us a letter, or hey, go to a one-day class on don't smoke anymore, it's probably not going to cut it. You need to have some kind of system in place for that. I looked at some of the state control stats, and if you look at TH, there's two kinds of THC, and the trooper knows a lot more about it than I do, but there's THC that they're looking for when you get arrested for drunk driving. You're looking for 5 nanograms or more in a milliliter of blood, I believe that's what, over 5 milligrams. If you're 21 and over, you can't have any more than 5 nanograms in your blood. If you're driving and you're over that, then the presumption is you're under the influence. Then there is the other type of THC that just says you've smoked marijuana at some point in time that's in your system. That particular type of the marijuana is increasing, so the more blood testing, it's basically said we see an increase in marijuana use in blood tests. But that doesn't really mean anything. We're talking about blood tests when you get arrested for drunk driving, because it used to be that if somebody refused a blood test and DUI arrest, we would just walk away. Okay, they refused. Now we get search warrants, and now our officers are better trained to establish why, hey, they may not be under the influence of alcohol, but either they're under the influence of marijuana or a combination of marijuana and alcohol. And then they get the probable cause, they get a search warrant, and then they get a drug, a blood draw. So the blood draws are actually going up. So naturally, the more blood draws you have, where people, even when people are refusing, where we didn't get any blood, now they're going up. So there's more. There's obviously going to be more blood draws with marijuana in them. So that's one of the things. So we have to look at stats very closely. And again, I'll let the trooper talk a little bit more about that. But according to WSP stats, since 2011, THC found in blood draws has increased from about 20% to 30% in cases where they're sent to the crime lab. The other thing we were talking about is, out of all DUI-related crashes in the last 3 years, 92% of crashes are alcohol and 8% are drugs or marijuana. But that's still not a very good statistic, because my understanding is, if you're arrested for being over the 0.08 alcohol in your blood, that's what you're charged with. You're not charged with if you have marijuana in your system. And the other reverse is true, is if you're under the 08 and you have the marijuana in your system, then you get charged with the drug part. So they're not really correlated. So you've got to be careful with those statistics. And then I passed around a couple of articles that you saw. You know, it depends on what you read, who wrote the article, on what the truth is in Colorado. Because if you look at, and you've got to look closely, because they're actually talking about two different things. But if you read the article, you go, gosh, marijuana use is up. We're finding more marijuana in people that are killed in traffic accidents, but traffic accidents overall are down. So marijuana must be safe. Because that's how I read that stuff, because it's okay to drive. But, so again, everybody's looking at Colorado because they started before us. And my impression is, it's too early to tell. That's just my impression from my point of view. So what are the issues related to law enforcement? I think we're spending too much time and resources discussing whether or not marijuana should be legalized. It's here, folks. So let's take this money that supposedly is going to the state and push it into prevention and education programs, because it's, I can tell you, it doesn't filter down to our level. You know, we don't, the local government doesn't get any of the money other than sales tax when you sell marijuana in the city of Battle Mountain or you sell it to the city of Vancouver. So the state needs to come up with some money. Let's do some prevention programs and some treatment programs. And then, hey, we also need to research the long-term effects of hash oil at high concentrations. I can tell you from my experience, and I can tell, I came from Southern California, the city of Irvine. They built a, had a bar come in our state called Sloppy Joe's. And Sloppy Joe's was a company out of Florida. Never been in California before. So they opened up in California, and they had a drink. It was 84 ounces. It's called a hammerhead. 84 ounces of grain alcohol and all kinds of other stuff. And you were supposed to share it with like 10 people. But we have people come in and they share it with themselves. They black out. We find them swinging from trees. We find them in fights. And it got to the point where the ABC, which is our equivalent liquor board, came and said, you've got to take that off the menu, because in California, you know, we don't drink. You're not supposed to drink till you pass out. It might be okay in Florida, but we don't like that in California. So the idea is, okay, we need to do some research and say, okay, what is this? How does this impact us? You know, is it a good thing to have concentrations of THC out there as high as 90%? Okay, I don't know. Because we regulate alcohol in our community. Maybe we need to regulate that. Traffic safety impacts on minors. I think that's another issue we need to look at. We need to tackle the e-cigarette issue. And then I think we also need to, for law enforcement, better testing the actual blood samples. And for us, some kind of roadside test. Because quite honestly, you know, when I started police work back 100 zillion years ago, we could dock a DUI arrest out in an hour. I mean, from the time you pull the guy over to you, you were booking him. Well, now if you have to get a search warrant in the middle of the night, you've got to wake up a judge, it can take 2.5 hours, and, you know, they're off the street. So we need a roadside test. So that's my, just telling you my personal opinion of how I think it's impacting our community. And then turn over to Cooper. So thank you.
Good evening. My name's Tom Sweat. I work here in Vancouver. I've been here for a couple of years. I worked in Allis County for 11 years. So I'm kind of familiar with this law, kind of what the chief was saying about changes of the process on DUI enforcement with marijuana. There was a lot of changes that kind of all happened at once. One time Washington was illegal, then all of a sudden it got legal with marijuana. At one time, whenever we saw someone for DUI drugs, we would go there and we'd say, hey, can we draw your blood? They'd say no, then it'd be a refusal. Now we can't do that really anymore. We have to go through the process, like Chief said, of getting a search warrant. Well, getting a search warrant is a lengthy process. He said 2.5-3 hours. Once you do everything else, you transcribe the telephonic search warrant, the whole process would be 5 to 8 hours. That's almost a whole shift on one DUI. That's a trooper off the road. When we only have a handful in Clark County, that's 20, 30, 40, 50% of our manpower off the road that entire shift, which is very, very time sensitive. So some of the things that we look for on impaired drivers is just like anything, regardless of prescription drugs, alcohol, marijuana, they have to be, you know, impaired. We do voluntary field sobriety tests roadside based upon their driving and their performance on field sobriety tests and questioning interviews. Then we decide if we're going to arrest them for DUI or not. Then based upon if they have ethanol or alcohol in their system, on where we go, we either take them to our office and a couple of police departments in the area or the jail where we have alcohol. BAC Data Masters, where we do alcohol testing. The only places that we can draw blood are the hospitals at night. So one thing that we used to do before is, anyone ever heard of a drug recognition expert, DRE? That's a specially trained law enforcement officer that's gone through weeks of classroom training as well as field training in the field. They usually go to like Seattle, very bad areas, and they evaluate people that are impaired by different types of drugs. And they are able, based upon your physiological effects, based upon how your body responds to drugs, they can kind of guess what type of drug that they're on. So the old days, and we still do it occasionally, once again, it's consent, that once we arrest someone, we would have a DRE, or drug recognition expert, evaluate this person, and based upon their experience and their knowledge, then let the officer or the trooper know that, yes, this person's impaired. Once they figure that out, they get the person, they type up a search warrant, they call the judge, or they have another guy go to the judge's house, wake him up in the middle of the night, sign it, bring it back, go to the hospital, two hospitals, draw the blood, And if they have a prior DUI, this is another thing that extends the process, not just 2.5 hours. Remember, I'm saying we're around 5 to 8 hours now. That if they have any prior DUI offense, it's mandatory that we book them in the jail. It's mandatory that we impound their car. Before, we would just say, oh, we're going to leave the car, lock it up, we'll have them, you know, do the blood test, we'll let, call a family member, come get them. Can't do that anymore. Obviously, bad things have happened in the past, which is why we have to have the legislature pass these laws to make it safer for the public, like mandatory impound and 12-hour holds, mandatory booking if they have any alcohol-related prior offenses. So all that stuff just extends the time. She was talking about earlier, to me earlier, about have we seen an increase of marijuana use with impaired drivers? Working down here, I haven't really seen that much of an increase, which is kind of surprising. Being as legal now, obviously, you talked about the two types of THC, one that's in your body for a long period of time, one that's a short time. Someone who smokes marijuana, the physiological effects on their ability to concentrate and drive, psychosocial skills, is very short-lived, you know, a couple hours. So if they smoke a joint or pipe or whatever and they start driving, we stop them. By the time we do the fields, by the time we tow their car, by the time we take the get a DRE evaluation, by the time we get a search warrant, by the time we draw their blood,
it's over.
It's over almost. It's almost over. Because a couple hours, it takes you a couple hours to do all that. Because it's mandatory that we tow the car. It's mandatory that we ask for a voluntary DRE. We ask them, they don't have to, but we ask them. You add all that time up, all that stuff's flushed out of their system. Just like ethanol, you drink a beer, and an hour later, you're pretty much, hour and a half later, you're pretty much down to zeros. You have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if there's any kind of field test that's being developed for marijuana, a breath test or a pinprick test or something. Is that in the works?
Not that I know. Not that I know. We have no way to test marijuana use in the field. That's a great idea. We would love to have some engineer, some developer, inventor create something like that that we could use in a field, because on alcohol we have testing, and this testing's been around for decades to test, and it's the same test that we use for different types of alcohol. We have alcohol testing, we have a PBT test where we have it out in our cars, and we can have someone blow in it, and it's not the legal test, but it kind of gives us an idea based upon our levels of impairment. So I discussed a couple years ago how we changed, you know, the marijuana law passed. We changed about towing cars mandatory. We changed about booking people mandatory. For probably a decade or two, we've had DREs. Since this marijuana law has passed, we've increased our level of training for all of our officers. Before, we've just had basic standardized field sobriety testing, which we learned at the academy. Since then, we had an advanced course, advanced roadside impaired driving enforcement called A-Ride, and we've given it to every officer that wants it. For us, it's mandatory. City and county, I don't think everyone's been through the training, but it's just an additional tool in your tool belt. So when you stop someone, additional testing that you can do to check someone to see if they're impaired by marijuana use. Some things we look for: eyelid tremors, dilated pupils, raised taste, you know, green in their mouth, raised taste buds, stuff like that. Well, about everyone that we stop that we think is impaired because of weaving or whatever, we do the same field sobriety testing, regardless. So, based upon the performance, is how far we go. Yes?
This increased process, was that initiated, is that solely for suspicion of marijuana intoxication, or is that now for all non-alcohol drugs? And did it come in with the legalization of marijuana in that law?
No, we always had the same testing, regardless if they were just marijuana or meth or heroin or coke or anything else. It's the same testing. We always did the same testing, the same process, regardless. Way before marijuana was even talked about within the last few years of legalizing, and of course legalizing now, we were doing the same thing way before then. The timeline was just coincidence.
Oh, okay.
For us to do the search warrant thing, that was a national case. That was a U.S. Supreme Court. So it had nothing to do with Washington. Right. Actually, it was a court case, I believe, out of Ohio, which is the U.S. Supreme Court now, for us to draw blood, we got to use search warrant. Before, we didn't have to. We could just take you down and say, hey, we're drawing your blood. Can't do anywhere. So that just increases the time. It'd be great if we had a field test kit, like a alcohol test kit. I was talking to some guys next door, and they're counselors on drug use, and we have a field test kit. If we actually have a sample of drugs, we can field test it. And then if it tests positive, then we send it to the crime lab. That's what we do. So the process, when we arrest someone, we get the search warrant, we take them to the hospital, we draw their blood. If they have a prior, we book them into jail, we get the blood, two vials, take it to our office, we do a bunch of forms. We send it to the state toxicology lab, located in Seattle, gets tested. It's a very slow process. Like I said, it takes 1 to 2 months, maybe 3, to get that blood back. So, backlog, more or less. The motto. But anyway, so that is the process. That is what we do. And does anyone have any questions about marijuana use and how that affects driving or anything to do with driving? That's kind of our specialty, our narrow.
I just had another question about, it used to be where you would just, I'm sure that the troopers could just smell marijuana. But yes.
Got to the window. So now with all the different devices and edibles, it must be really hard to determine what somebody's on. Yes. I actually had training last week, last Thursday, La Center Middle School Day, which is La Center United, an organization in La Center. They offered some training to law enforcement about recognizing marijuana use. I attended this training. For a couple hours, they had an instructor from Des Moines come down, and he was talking about edibles and e-cigarettes that you guys were talking about before, and you're right, can't smell it, can't see it. That's the problem with kids today, is that you go to a party, they go to school, they get ready to school, it could be, special brownies, funny brownies, but there's so many different ways. They showed us candy, Pop-Tarts, everything that looks exactly the same. And this, I remember 10 years ago when meth was coming out, and they started bringing out strawberry meth. Why do they want strawberry meth? Does meth users care what flavor it is? No, it's to hook the young kids, get them started on something that's fun and flavorful and exciting or whatever. So they have Pop-Tarts now that you can buy at these places. It's not called Pop-Tarts, but something similar. It's in the same type of box. So these kids can start it, they start using it, and then obviously, just like the chief was saying, they started regular marijuana use. And then when they get immune to that, they don't even feel it anymore. Then they go to stronger. And you go to these marijuana places, the concentration of the marijuana, you can get a kind of like a beer. You get a light beer, you get a heavy beer, you get a super strong beer, you get a shot of Everclear. They're all different strengths, and marijuana is the same way. Once these people get immune to the regular smoking out of the pipe, then they go to hash. And like the chief said, they're all the way up to 90%. Hash. Some of the training that they explained last week was these people are going on YouTube and they have this marijuana and they're going to make hash oil because they're immune to the marijuana and they need a bigger high because they don't even feel it anymore. It's kind of like an alcoholic. They can't just drink one beer and get drunk. Now they have to drink a case. Kind of like a marijuana user. They can't just smoke a joint. They need hash oil. So they're creating, they're watching YouTube videos on how to make this hash oil. So they're making their homes, putting into freezers, and they're blowing refrigerators up, they're blowing washing machines up. When they wash their marijuana and they drain it, and I don't know if you've seen that in Battleground down here in Clark County, up in the Sound, it's happening more and more up there in the Puget Sound area. So these people that are trying to make hash oil that are, thank the chemists, blowing stuff up, kind of like what we had years ago with meth labs, kind of the same thing. Dummies trying to make something hash oil so they can sell it and use it and get their high off of that. So, any question over here?
I was just wondering, when you're talking about the whole search warrant process, so, by the time you get somebody to the hospital and do a blood test, wouldn't their blood, wouldn't, like, if it was an alcohol or prescription drugs or anything like that, wouldn't it pretty much be dissipated?
Mm-hmm. It'll still be in your system, but it'll be lower.
Well, like then, wouldn't that kind of then in a nullify your case against the person you're trying to charge with?
It won't nullify it. Just like there's two per se laws in Washington. One is alcohol. Your window is 0.08, right? Mm-hmm. You're over 21, you're 0.08, you are drunk. If you're under 21 and you're 0.02, you are DUI minor. They have the same thing with marijuana, where 21 and over, you're 5.0 nanograms, you're impaired. If you're under 21, you have any THC, you're impaired. But all the other drugs, you know, all the other drugs, prescription drugs, we don't have a per se law. So the officer, as they're driving behind him down the road, and they describe his driving, they describe that he can't even stand up straight. They describe, you know, all these stuff that normal people can do, walk in a straight line, finger to nose, your alphabet, count to whatever. Normal people can do that. When you're impaired, you won't be able to do that. So when you draw your blood 2-3 hours later, and they show that all those drugs, whether it's Vicodin or cocaine or heroin or whatever's in your system, usually it's a cocktail. They don't just usually have one, they have numerous poly drug use. So if the officer can show that they did not drive like a normal person, they can't communicate like a normal person, they can't do any tests like a normal person, and 2-3 hours later there's all these drugs in their system, that's good evidence for the prosecutor to present to the jury to get a DUI conviction. Mm-hmm. So you won't always have that 5 nanograms, but you'll have some. Mm-hmm. And based upon the totality of the circumstances, everything that the officer saw from the first second, you know, is going to be admissible. So anyone else have any questions about, yes?
So in regards to the backlog and the amount of time and the blood testing, from the time that you arrest someone until you get the prosecution, how long is that?
Prosecution, that's a whole other case. I'm talking to prosecutor about that. That's a whole other story. That could be a year later.
It could be a year later. What we do a lot of times in our cases, because there's another catch to this whole thing, especially at our level, local government. If we get arrested drunk driver, and let's say you get mandatory 30 days in jail, well, we have to pay the daily bed rate for that guy. So, you know, if he goes to around here, it's like 60, 70 bucks a day. But if it's a long-term thing, we send him out to Skamania, or we send him out to Loftoe, because they only charge us $25 a day. So a lot of times the prosecutors keep it down to like, is it a nickel? I forgot, we call it wet reckless, but it's almost the same amount of penalties and stuff, but they don't do the jail time. So that's another thing they do, it so that cities don't have to pay all this money to put the person in jail. Okay? So it's very complicated why people get prosecuted, why they don't. I mean,
it's a long process, just like passing a law. There's a lot of working parts in it. They don't really tell us that much. Yeah. We just know it's a long, arduous process. And like the chief said, you know, if you don't have a very strong case, you know, like you're talking about, a lot of time, and there's really not that much. Those are the cases where they would likely plead down to reckless or neg one. But if you have a slam dunk case and everything's perfect, they're not going to plead. We're going to go to trial.
Right.
They'll usually plead guilty anyway. That's usually, you know, for reduced charging. But usually the prosecutors in the local area, they, when you're impaired, they'll go to court. I've been in court 5 times on everything.
So, but how much time is that in between, like when you have to go to court, and do you even remember this person anymore? I mean, as time passes, I mean, I think that would be incredibly hard in your position to have to go and testify. And I mean, if it happened 6 weeks ago, I'd be like,
that's part of the reason why a good defense attorney will push it out. Because the longer you can push it out, the more people get. I mean, that's one thing. You know, you hope that evidence gets lost, that the trooper gets transferred to Spokane, or you know, whatever. So there's a million different reasons why you do that. But it's a, but then again, you know, you have to understand too, and I get the other side of it. If you get convicted of a DUI in the state, it's expensive. I mean, it is, especially when you compare it to some other crimes. That, hey, you know, in some cases you're actually going to probably get paid more money long term between what you pay in fines and penalties and your insurance and a dozen other things. So that's the way our system is.
Well, the way the court system is, they have a speedy trial, or if you get charged for a crime, you have a right to a speedy trial.
Yeah.
And then if you waive that, then they push it out, just like the chief was saying. They hope that one of the court arraignments that you don't show up. Or the person that tested the blood from the Seattle Pox Lab. There goes the case. So they try to push it out as long as possible to make you forget. Now all of our officers have cameras in their cars, so they always watch the camera, the video before they go to court. Refresh your memory. Read your report 2, 3, 4 times before you go to court. Refresh your memory. So that's what they hope. They try to poke holes in our reports, poke holes in everything that we do to try and get it dismissed or thrown out. But if you have a rock solid case, we'll get a conviction. And all goes with experience and training.
Yeah, the experience and training being, I think, for the trooper or for even I guy, just patience. Understanding the way the system works and that you have to build a case. Just like a homicide or anything else, you got to figure out all the holes that the defense attorney is going to go after, and you plug them with good report writing, asking the right questions, collecting the evidence. And so, you know, in those cases, it doesn't matter if you go next week or next year, they're solid cases. And and the better the case is, the defense attorney will look at that. And even the defense attorneys know who writes a good DUI, who doesn't a good DUI, who doesn't. And they'll look at it and go, oh, this is from so-and-so. Forget it. I'm not going to take that on the court. So.
A lot of times, a lot of departments are busy. Like PPD, they get really busy. So obviously, they have to deal with a lot more fun clientele. So a lot of time, when they stop a car and they're impaired, they call us. So they'll stop a car, they write us a little paragraph. This guy was weaving all over. We get there, it's our case, we take over. So it saves them time. You know, we get the person off the road, we get the conviction. Obviously, we do this a lot more than city or county does, so we go a lot more training, we have a lot more experience, so this is what we're used to. So.
Outside of the road test, the roadside test, is there any either city or county level policy that we can advocate for that's in your two opinion or intuition that would be the next best bet? What's our best bet at this stage? On the data we have, how do we advocate for this?
You know, it's hard. I think the roadside test is important. I think long term, and this is speaking as a police chief, the criminal justice system, court system needs to change, because the court system operates Monday through Friday 9 to 5, and the rest of the world doesn't. And there's times, and I don't know how it is for state patrol, but there's times where you're calling down the list trying to find a judge that's going to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't have to answer the phone. So a lot of times it's a personal relationship you have with a judge, and you have his personal number or whatever. Because we have guys that, hey, I can't get the regular judge, so I'll call back in, and I've got a personal relationship with the judge, and he'll come and do the search warrant. I think that search warrant process, someday we're going to have to streamline that too, because that is, you know, if it takes you three hours to find a judge, you wake them up at 3 o'clock in the morning, hey, that's an issue. So I think, you know, but that's going to be an act of God, because they're, you know, lawyers.
This also highlights the reason why we need to be into prevention. I mean, these guys, by the time we get to these guys, there's been a failure somewhere in the system. So the prevention piece is essential.
And I think, you know, if you look at the system, we did a pretty good job in this country, tobacco, educating people on don't smoking and don't drink and drive. I mean, we really have. And so now we have to start looking, okay, now we've got these whatever you call these, the inhaling devices, and, you know, the marijuana stuff, we've got to start tackling it. We lost the public relations war on legalized marijuana. While they were out there selling the benefits and marijuana will cure everything, we really didn't have a voice out there, a strong enough voice. And so now you see all this legalization. So now we have to kind of back, you know, now we have to be, we're kind of behind the curve, and we've got to catch up. That's how I look at it. So.
Kind of bounce off what you were saying, a way we can speed the process other than going to the judge's house in the middle of the night or doing a whole telephonic warrant over a reporting line. I have friends in Lewis County and friends in Spokane County, and what they do with their judges is they have to have their own computer at their home, they have to have their own connection at home, but how that works there is they type the officer types a warrant in their car, emails it to the judge, judge looks at it, yep, sends it back, done. They get, you know, our communications officer calls and wakes the judge up, says, hey, are you available to proof a warrant? Approve a warrant. Says yes, he wakes up, he turns his computer on, trooper's almost done, emails it to him, 5 minutes later it's back. Then that's a approved search warrant. We haven't got that far yet in Clark County yet, but that's what we're trying to evolve to. We have Target Zero teams. Anyone hear about Target Zero teams? Okay. We have specialized troopers in the state of Washington that were approved by the Washington Fire Safety Commission, funded by the federal government, gave a grant to the state. The state implemented traffic safety teams, and what these specialized troopers and a sergeant, six troopers, one sergeant, there's one assigned to Pierce County, Snohomish County, Keene County, Yakima County, Spokane County, what they do, all they do is DUIs. They work nights only. They go out. They don't answer calls. They don't go to collisions. They don't go to DBs. They don't do anything else. They go out and find impaired drivers. And studies have shown, which I just read it last week, that they have drastically reduced impaired driving collisions in those counties. Wow. By double digits. So we are, Clark County's the next place in the state to get one. Or do we six troopers and a sergeant, that's all they do, which will be about twice as much as we have right now.
And what was the name of that? That
Target Zero team. Target Zero
team. Target Zero team?
Yes. So it's been very, very good. And before they implemented, before they decided what counties are going to put them in, they looked at data, found out where people are killing themselves or killing others, and they, obviously, Puget Sound, Pierce, Snow, and King County, that's the biggest areas killing each other. And then Spokane and Yakima over the next, Clark County is the one after that. So based upon population and people dying under the influence.
So. What about, I just read something from the CDC recently about the crashes of long-haul truck drivers and their known to use substances. Are you seeing any trends there with, you know, the big trucks, 18-wheelers that travel, and, you know, sometimes they don't get enough sleep, and then they also, is there any data that you have about that, them? And
we don't have any data about that, but that has been on our radar for a while, yes, because they're only allowed to drive so many hours. Falsified logbooks.
Substance, you know, it's pretty dangerous. So.
Yeah, most drugs I've gotten off truck drivers is nothing that needs to get the stimulant to keep them going to drive 24 hours instead of, because they get paid by the mile. And if you can drive 24 instead of 11. So, yeah. Same rules apply to them as applies to regular driver. Actually, their alcohol limit is cut in half as a regular driver. Yeah. 0.04 commit.
You
can
do a lot of that.
Yes, that's why we have Port of Entry and Richfield, and it's open 24 hours a day, except holidays. So, right, long as we have staff. That's all we have. We're down 150 people in the state, our agency. And we have 700 to 800 troopers.
That's a lot.
So. Is that because of funding or lack of applicants?
Well, I'm sure every chief in the state and in this country would probably say the same thing. Lack of qualified applicants, and we're the lowest paid in the county, our agency. So why would they want to come to work for here when they can make $1,000 more a month working in Vancouver?
And local, yeah.
I mean, common sense to me. I mean,
well,
I
was most of us
well, we don't have the hats that they have.
You make $1,000 more than they
have.
Priceless.
You have questions about traffic law enforcement, effects of marijuana, alcohol, drug use, what we look for, how we process, anything like that, trends. Like I said, it's not really trending. We haven't seen that really
you know, like everything goes up and down and hasn't been spiking like you were thinking it was going to. So,
appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Moving on to the proposed SIP law regarding vaping devices, Dr. Mennick.
So you have in your packet our proposed ordinance for the to present to the Board of Health. I've done so basically we already have in our county. Let me backtrack. First of all, electronic device, inhalant delivery devices, these electronic devices are not regulated federally, and up till now they haven't been regulated in the state. There's no regulations about these things. A few years ago in Clark County, we passed an ordinance, our Board of Health passed an ordinance that basically banned the sale of these to minors. But elsewhere in the state of Washington, and actually nationally, you can be 6 years old and buy an e-cigarette. They're totally unregulated. And by the way, the contents of these devices, the canisters, are totally unregulated as well. The FDA has no regulations around these. And a lot of them, I believe, I've heard, are produced in China and Korea. We know not what's in a lot of these canisters that go into this. A couple of years ago, like I said, the Board of Health in Clark County passed an ordinance that basically said you cannot sell these devices or distribute these devices to minors. So the board did that. Statewide now we have this legislation that we talked about earlier that would further restrict the possession and the distribution and the marketing of these devices to minors. So that's pending, and hopefully that legislation will go somewhere. The one thing that still, that either the state legislation or the federal or what we have locally does, is prohibit the use of these devices where smoking is prohibited. So right now you can go into a restaurant, you can go into any public place, any place of employment, and use these devices. And we have, we've had some concerns about this for a couple of reasons. One is, regardless of what you're hearing about these, the vape that comes out of these devices is not necessarily a benign or safe material. There's and actually the ordinance talks about this, but again, the contents of these canisters are not regulated. You can put, it's already been mentioned, you can put THC into these devices as well as other psychoactive substances. The vapor that comes out of these, they call it vapor, but it's actually kind of, depending on what's in the canister, can contain a lot of different substances, including but not limited to cancer-causing agents like formaldehyde. But, you know, right now, you can be sitting next to somebody in a movie theater who's vaping, you know, who's using these devices. So what we'd like to do in with our board, and our board, I've done one-on-ones with two of our Board of Health members. I have another one yet to do. We'd like to do is have them consider passing an ordinance that would ban the use of what we call them inhalant delivery systems. And the reason we're calling them inhalant delivery systems is that the word e-cigarette doesn't apply anymore because these things have exploded in terms of the type of device, you know, what they look like. You can actually get an e-hookah now, and you can look up pictures of e-hookahs. You know, some of these devices look like toys, and so we're actually calling them now inhalant delivery systems, and I think that's what the wording is used. So basically what this ordinance does is it takes the existing county code, and if you go to page 4 and onward, it describes, it changes the language, it would change the language in our county code. This would have the force of law. We're now calling them vaping devices, actually inhalant delivery systems, and you can see that the one of the things that this does, if you'll read through this, is prohibit the use of these devices in places where tobacco is prohibited. So these devices would have to comply with the SIP law. What we'd like to do is we have to give to pass an ordinance in because this has enforcement associated with it, so it's the invokes the police powers of the state that we would be that our Board of Health would be exercising here. We have to give at least 10 days notice before the board can actually take action on this. So the next board, our next Board of Health meeting is next week. It's the 25th. We don't have 10 days to do this. So what we'd like to do is get this on the Board of Health agenda for April. It would be the fourth Wednesday of April. But it would be great for you guys, as you know, you've already done this with what we, you know, the your recommendations last month. Is it would be helpful for if you were supportive of this for the Public Health Advisory Council to go on record as supporting a letter of support or whatever to the Board of Health, supporting their efforts to basically pass this ordinance. The other thing about this, besides the concern about secondhand exposure to vapor, and I think it's already pointed out in terms of the youth, the way youth really observe adults engaged in this behavior. So the more we can actually restrict the use of these devices in public, the less I think we can get the rates of youth use down by further restricting the use of these devices. We're not suggesting anybody ban these devices. People would still be free to, whatever you want to call it, turn them on in their home or as long as they're 25 feet away from an entrance to a public building, but basically regulate them the same way we regulate tobacco in this county. So I've been blabbering long enough. We can go through this in detail if you want, but that's basically the gist of this. Yeah, but which is already, the existing ordinance already prohibited the sale to minors. I don't know if it's crossed out or put in. The changes in the code are the ones, the earlier language that's in the code has been crossed out and the new language is underlined. So what this basically does is, it expands the ban to sale of minors to what we call inhalant delivery devices. So it's a broader term. If that makes sense.
I've been considering this statewide, and I've been thinking about talking to our legislators about doing this similar type of thing statewide.
Yeah, we'd love to see that
happen. One small step at a time. We'll do it here, and then it'll catch on and it'll progress. But I think some of our legislators are already aware of this, and I wanted to find out the thoughts as far as going to Olympia and talking to some of us that, like Senator Rivers and also Representative Harris, Paul Harris.
Yeah, they're sponsors of the current vacant, which is good legislation. They're both sponsoring those.
They're sponsoring with regards to sale to minors, but the indoor smoking or vaping is not part of their of the program, so I was thinking about expanding that so that it would be something that would be statewide.
I think it's a great idea. That's not going to happen this legislative session.
Right.
That's why we're hoping to get our board and I don't know. We don't know what's going to happen the next legislative session, but we were hoping that. Some other counties in the state have already done this, I believe, and we're hoping that we could. Pending state legislation, right. If it passed, obviously.
Yeah, Oregon's doing the same thing. They're moving towards the Clean Indoor Act.
Multnomah County just passed this basic ordinance.
Right.
Multnomah County did it.
I think we need to do this letter. I think we need to have people at that meeting on April 22nd. Yeah, I just put it on my calendar, April 22nd, I think. Not only to have a letter, but to have representatives from the council actually being there supporting this. Yeah, April 22nd.
And by the way, the stuff about prohibiting in public places is on page 8 of 24.20.085.
That's also the point of the community board.
I would be one of those that behind that,
right? Yeah, we're actually hoping, if you guys are supportive, to get some folks from the restaurant industry involved.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went up to, we have an annual visit to our legislators by the Restaurant Association. And so in February, we went up there, and I kind of on the sideline, I wear a couple of hats because I represent the restaurants. But every time I talk to a legislator, I always throw a little something in there for public health. So, you know, and this particular session, I was talking about e-cigarettes. You know, and I talked to Mr. Harris at that time also. I surveyed some of the restaurateurs. I talked to the Restaurant Association itself, and they said this is not something that's high on their priorities, okay? However, I did talk to a lot of the restaurateurs, and some of them were in full agreement that they did not want to see any type of, whether it be vaping or smoking or whatever you want to call it, devices back in their place again. You know, they've gotten rid of cigarettes. Now they prefer not to even see something that looks like anything like that. So I think that there would be a lot of them that would be most definitely, as far as the association is concerned, there's no position on it as yet. But a lot of restaurateurs expressed that they did not want to see it back in the restaurant.
If you could help bring some of those folks to the board hearing, that would be great. If you are all supportive of this. I mean, if you support this, and we'll work with Trevor, we'll draft a letter, and we'll work with Trevor and the executive committee to put something together that would basically sit, just kind of like we did last month with the other.
I just stepped out briefly. Did I miss a formal motion? Or
I mean, I suggest
you already did.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Any other discussion regarding the draft ordinance and vaping devices? Okay, we'll move to the ACES update. I'm not certain which staff member, Roxanne.
Joan, did you
want to
chat about this?
Well, since I missed the meeting, why don't you go out?
Oh, okay, sure. Okay, so basically, originally we were talking about the Raising of America event, and we had that on the schedule for April 23rd. We had the chance to view the full document, documentary, is that the parade? Is it a documentary? I'm not sure what it is, but anyway, we had the chance to review the full film when it came out. And it wasn't exactly what we had thought that it would be based on their previous information to us. And so we decided as a planning committee, the collaborative planning committee decided to take that event off the calendar for April 23rd and have another dialogue about how to roll the conversation of ACES out into the community. We want to make sure that it's an inclusive conversation. We don't want to exclude anybody from the table. And I think in order to get the conversation going, the planning committee thought that maybe what we should do is have a different approach. So the intent is still to roll out the event. It's going to be later in the year, and it's not going to be during Public Health Week. We were hoping to have it ready for Public Health Week, but we will need a little bit more time. So, Joan,
yeah, I just want to say that, you know, it's quite political, and what we don't want to do is stop the conversation in our community about this whole issue of building resilience before it starts. And, you know, anytime you have any kind of document, it's very different than what we saw when we saw the trailer earlier last year. When you see the full feature that we would be showing, you know, there could be people that would be walking out of the theater. We don't want to do that because there's a strong political element to it. And so we want to approach it in a different way. To make sure that we have a viable, strong community conversation about what we can do to address, you know, resilience about ACES in our community. So, like Roxanne said, we're going to plan, you know, an event, but we don't have time right now between now and just a month away to sort of revamp everything. So we postpone that, but we will be planning an event because it's one of the things that our council has taken on, and we're working with a very committed group of folks in the ACES Collaborative who actually supported this as well. You know, that we take more time to develop a plan so that we have all the it's inclusive, like Roxanne said, business, schools, you know, we don't want this to become so partisan that we have a non-event. So,
and I do think that the intent is that the planning committee will come back and present the progress that they're making with regard to this and when the next event is going to be planned and what that event, the format of what that event is going to be.
And I think some of that is our role on the council as well as public health role. Our role on the council is, as Roxanne said, we want to be inclusive, and our role is to represent all the constituents in our community. And it's going to take a little bit more work. We're probably going to use some of the part of raising with America, but how we do it, how we put a program together, and build then the follow up cafe conversations. It's going to take a little bit more planning work.
Thank you for your update. We're at the public comment portion of the agenda, which really equates to University of Portland students this evening.
I thought if we could introduce ourselves so they know who we are. I mean, they know
absolutely.
I think it would be interesting for them to see who we all are, because you're all different
people. I'm Trevor Evers. I'm the Public Works Director of the City of Washougal. I'm representing public water purveyors within Clark County, public water systems.
I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief of Battleground, and I represent what we call the OEC, the Law Enforcement Council, and that's all the police chiefs and the sheriff of Clark County. And so we have a board, and I represent on that board. I'm on this board for that
board. And I represent the veterinarians.
And I'm Roger Turner. I'm the director of surgical and interventional services at the OEC and Creek Medical Center.
I'm Alton Roberts. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of the Peace Health in Southwest.
I'm
Alton Roberts.
I'm the Public Health Director of Health Officer.
And you know me,
and
I'm on this council as a non-elected representative from the City of Vancouver. Nurse.
My name is Stephanie. I'm a nurse, and I represent a nurse working in Clark County. I'm Karen Evans. I'm a community volunteer and represent nonprofits.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurants of Southwest Washington.
Mark Collier, I'm a septic system designer, and I represent designers and septic installers and operation maintenance specialists.
I'm Remy Hughes, I'm a pediatric dentist up in Salmon Creek, and I represent the Dental Society.
I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Clark County Public Health.
I'm Bryce Hackett, I'm a current high school student at Columbia River High School. I represent Youth Perspective in the county.
I'm Greg Nolkin. Hearing all these credentials, I'm humbled. I'm a physical therapist with Peace Health, and I represent on this board consumer health care.
Don Strick, I'm the communications manager for Clark County Public Health.
And I'm Julie Grimm, and I'm the staff support for the council.
And I'm Janice Koch, I'm the chief performance officer for Clark County Public Health.
Adiba Ali, epidemiologist for Clark County Public Health.
Thank you, everyone. Is there anything specific tonight to the public that struck you or something maybe you weren't aware of in working through the agenda on vaping devices and some of the issues that law enforcement are dealing with currently and recent legalization? Anything that struck you, don't feel obligated to pick anything, but just wanted to put it out there for you for public comment.
Really struck. I didn't realize that the devices aren't regulated by the FDA whatsoever. It's like shocking and pretty scary to think about. So that was
I didn't know PCH could be, I thought it was all the flavored oils. I didn't know they could put the cheap.
PCH?
Yeah. No. I don't know if they put that in there.
I don't know what
Yeah, you can put just about any psychoactive substance you want in a vaping device.
So is that vapor that comes out of comes out that they release, does that have the...
There'll be some of it, sure.
But you can't get a contact high from it.
Well, it depends on how close and how much of it you inhaled in. I mean, if you're sitting this far away, probably not.
But if it smells like gummy bears, then you're just kind of...
Yeah.
The trap. Right?
But if you're it's like people who get exposed to tobacco smoke, you can measure the tobacco metabolites in their urine. So if you were close enough to people vaping devices and inhale some of it, you could probably, depending on the sensitivity of your test, measure metabolites.
Well, it's like anything with secondhand smoke. If you're sitting in a room full of people vaping, you know, if you go to one of the vaping places and you sit there and everybody's vaping, well, you're bound to absorb something.
Well, I just thought they didn't know yet how much, what exactly was in the steam that comes from a vaping.
It depends on the device. It depends on the heat.
Have they measured it yet?
Yeah, like the study done at PSU that was in the New England Journal of Medicine found levels of formaldehyde that was in the vaping.
But not THC, did they?
Oh, it depends. I don't know the answer to that. It depends on the concentration of THC in your little canister.
Well, you can add it.
You can add as much as you want.
Right.
You can
add it. But we don't know how much is in the vapor that comes out.
I'm talking about people who are just...
I don't know if that study has been done by looking at different canisters of different concentrations and measuring THC levels. It would depend on a number of factors.
So Bryce was talking about students that do that.
At my high school, there's up to a dozen students at any time standing off of school property, smoking, vaping, who knows what they load, essentially everything in these canisters. And some things you can smell on smoking in person, some things you can't, but you can certainly tell that what they are vaping is having some psychological effects.
The amount in the vapor depends on a number of factors.
So my stepdaughter goes there. I'm going to give you her picture, and you can tell me if you see her.
So, Bryce, have you seen any of those? I know that there are devices where you could actually be vaping in a classroom because these devices look like you
They look like pens. They can sit in your pocket. Yeah, I've seen them used in classrooms, on campus, off campus, anywhere. And then the vapor dissipates.
So ones that contain THC are called hallucinogenic joints. I don't know if you've heard that from...
I've actually seen them vape in the health department. I saw one the other day.
Here?
Yeah.
Oh, vaping in the building?
Yeah.
Oh. One of our staff.
Yeah,
it's
one of our staff.
Yeah, that's the problem with these devices, that they can be used anywhere. You know, you can... Yeah.
They don't even look like cigarettes or anything.
Some of them look like toys, actually.
Yeah, they come in many different...
Well,
they're very efficient drug delivery devices. They're very efficient drug delivery devices. And actually, some of the manufacturers not only put high levels of nicotine in these devices, but put other substances that help speed the absorption of nicotine. So it's not unlike what the industry has done with regular cigarettes in terms of making them efficient nicotine delivery devices. The other thing that's happened with these is that nicotine can be absorbed through the skin, and I think there's been poisoning instances of children getting some of the fluid on their skin, as well as ingesting it. If you ingest them, some of the liquids, it could be damaging as well.
I think you mentioned at the last meeting that that there's this perception that e-cigarettes are somehow healthier or not as harmful as regular cigarettes. And so I do think that it's going to be challenging getting the message out because we're already fighting against this whole perception of, well, it's better for us. We're not smoking, we're vaping. It's completely different. You know, so it's going to be very challenging trying to get the message out so that people understand it, number one, and then listen to it is also another issue and act on it.
One of the arguments in favor of these things that the vaping community has been using is that it's a harm reduction system and that people can use these actually to get off of nicotine and get off of tobacco. But the evidence is not really clear that that is really the case in terms of studies that have been done. And in fact, some people use them in areas where they aren't allowed to smoke, and then as soon as they're in an area where they can, they go back to tobacco. And the other concern about that is that these are very efficient devices for getting children addicted to nicotine. So, but the jury is out in terms of these as a harm reduction device in terms of quitting use.
So you're going to need to watch and see on campus, you know, I bet you're going to see vaping devices. Just watch.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's smoking their pen.
They've actually created those devices to look glamorous. They kind of look a little Hollywoodish, you know. And I see
like
people
tobacco.
That I see some very well dressed ladies smoking these things now, including my friend.
I was just reading an article about children, just along with the article about the meeting yesterday. And it said that the State Poison Control Center in 2010 had two calls on nicotine-laced fluids. And 2014, they had 182 calls along that same line, and 133 of them involved children. And that last year in New York, a one-year-old died from drinking vapor fluid. So it's showing that there's
nicotine is a very, very powerful poison. It's very, very toxic. And actually, agricultural workers who work in, you know, pick tobacco, they can get absorption into the skin. They get a whole bunch, you know, they're subject to some of the effects as well. So it is a very potent toxin.
I noticed that in this article there was a couple of mentions about our Washington State Health Secretary.
Yes.
Mr.
Wiesman?
Yeah, Dr. Wiesman. He was mentioned several times in the article. So. Well, it makes me feel right at home.
So again, we're not, this doesn't ban them completely, it just basically says they can't be used in public places. That's all.
Great. Any other discussion for this evening? I feel like we're pretty efficient tonight and covered a lot of ground. With that, entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
My shirt. You know what? I've had this shirt for years. I don't even remember where I got it. It's one of the few I have left. I don't have a wardrobe budget, so everything I have, I just threw one a shirt away last night. The theme so far. I'm like, honey, I can't wear this one anymore.